strengthening subcommittee on human resources this afternoon, and our intent today is to do a work session on the portion of House Bill 5029, which is the Senior and Disabled Services Division. And I guess the first thing I'd like to know is who is the author of this sheet of paper? Is anybody going to say? I would like for any papers that come to us to our at our desk to have some attribution from whom it is, so that we have an idea who wrote this, who's saying this.
Could you ask your name? Put it on here.
Your name, Phyllis.
Do you have another copy of that?
No, you don't need it. Here.
Thank you.
Okay. What we're going to do is I'm going to have John Britton, our analyst, go over the reshoot that the entire budget, but he's going to go over the bullet points. We have the sheet of paper in front of us, and we'll have a...
They don't have it.
Oh, okay. So we'll have a discussion about the issues that are included on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like this afternoon to go down this list of recommendations, as we have done before with Adult and Family Services and the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. These are recommendations that are changes or would be changes to the governor's recommended budget as printed and distributed last December. So I'd like to just go down the list with you. The first has to do with the Department of Human Resources reshoot or re-estimation of the governor's recommended budget. LFO is recommending that we accept all the DHR reshoot items except for three of them. These are related to the rebalanced disappropriations that we made a couple of weeks ago. And there are three reshoot items that LFO recommends not be funded. The first is, in the reshoot, there was one item for the AAA non-Medicaid reimbursable activities. I asked SDSC to find out what those activities were, and they reported that after reviewing the timesheets and the other documents that are used to develop the reimbursement rate, that they found that there might have been mistakes on the timesheets, and this is about $700,000, and we're recommending not funding it. The second bullet under the reshoot.
So this is just $700,000 worth of mistakes?
As I understand it from SDSC, there were recording problems. They are no longer considering these to be non-Medicaid reimbursable activities and have told me that they don't need the funding for that.
Thank you.
The second bullet under the reshoot were food stamp error rate remediation. This was $1.2 million and 12 FTE. We are recommending not funding this remediation effort with additional general fund, but instead recommend that the agency SDSC find the money and make the efforts to reduce the food stamp error rates. There is some indication that some of the efforts that have been made are paying off. They apparently have experienced a lower error rate, I believe, in January of this year, and we recommend that those efforts continue, but we do not recommend adding general funds for further food stamp remediation.
And John, could I just ask a question
for
about this particular issue? Do you have the ability, if there are errors made in other offices, that, for instance, the AAA office or in some other office that you don't have as great an oversight over, do you have the ability to pass on any of the penalties?
Cost of the error.
Yeah, the penalties for that?
For the record, I'm Gary Weekstrack to the Department of Human Resources, and the short answer is no. I mean, we are the agency responsible for the food stamp program, and we contract the AAAs to do a lot of this work. So I don't believe we have the authority to ask them to pick up a share of the penalty. What we need to focus on, Ian, and that what this package was intended to do, or this piece of the budget was intended to do, was to get out there with the AAAs and do more training with them in the same way we have in the AFF side. The AFF, as John has already mentioned, I think, side of their error rate has actually gone down dramatically because we really invested in it. We spent some time with our caseworkers. We have to do the same on the AAAs, and we need to secure from the AAAs a commitment that this is going to be important from their staff position, too, by the recommendation, we'll just have to figure out how to do that without any resources and stuff. But we are going to be on the AAAs over there.
And I would just say that if there is anything that we can do in the legislature to help either give you the authority to, sometimes when all of a sudden you become responsible financially for errors that are made. The priority switches, and all of a sudden, you recognize the importance, and we will not have any hissing. And if we have hissing in this room, I will remove you. So,
Madam Chair, I don't think it's because the AAAs want to make errors. I think we just have to make a more concerted effort with the AAAs, tell them that this is critical. This could cost us $1 million in the next biennium if we don't bring this error rate down. And I think by impressing that on the AAAs, we're going to get cooperation from the AAAs, and we'll do that.
Madam Chair,
Representative Wilson,
could we have just a little bit of an explanation on the types of errors or what are errors and how that's affecting our families and so forth.
John?
Representative Loken and Madam Chair, the error rate is not specifically the number of cases adjudicated or determined with eligibility compared with the number of cases that were wrongly decided. The error rate is determined by the dollars either for good or ill, that is, a larger benefit and a smaller benefit compared to the total dollars adjudicated. So if, for example, we had $1,000 of benefits and for two claims and one of them was $100 higher than it ought to have been and the other was $100 lower, then we'd have a 20% or $200 divided by $1,000 error rate. So that's how the error rate is determined.
Mm-hmm.
The FDIC provided me with a memo that talked about the error rate issue. When they looked at the quality control case reviews, or when they did quality case reviews, they made the following points: that over 50% of the food stamp errors could have been prevented. The information was available in the file. So they had the right information. They may not have paid attention to detail, whatever, but the most common error of all, 50 to 70% of the time, has been, quote, disregarding or not taking action on information received.
Mm-hmm.
So
is that due to just not knowing the rules or just, working too quickly or assuming things and not situations and
Representative Loken, huh? Loken and Madam Chair, part of the reason, and this memo goes on to say that the reasons for the error, in countless contacts with FDSC management and staff, the overwhelming outcries, the increased caseload allotment to each worker. So they are attributing it to the fact that caseworkers have a lot to do and they may miss the details on this particular piece of a case of the case review.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure I would just one more thing, not to belabor this, but it's important for me to say, in addition to John's remarks, is it's not only the AAAs that are making errors.
No.
We run an SDSD system that includes a lot of reliance on AAAs, but our own staff are making some of these errors.
Mm-hmm.
I think we pointed that out, and I hope we pointed that out in a minute. But I don't want to lay all this at the doorstep of the AAAs. We have to work with our own SDSD staff as well as the AAA partners. So we,
one additional question. Well, even if even with more the additional funding, what would change? I mean, it would seem that the facts are there, the process is established, and it's simply paying attention to it and following it. I don't know where additional training would come into that, but maybe.
Actually, you know, Representative Loken, that's actually the way I looked at it, too.
Mm-hmm.
If reducing the error rate becomes a real priority, regardless of your caseload,
mm-hmm.
because if you make errors, you have penalties for those errors.
Mm-hmm.
If we have penalties, then that is funding that also is gone. So it just seems that because this package was going to take temporary people and go out in the field and teach them, well, if you look at the information, I really believe that these errors, if a priority is placed upon the folks that are doing the work, that it will go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
I'm sure.
That's Senator Shields.
Yes, in response to Representative Loken's questions, part of it also has to do with the equity questions we've raised before. In fact, mm-hmm. with Kennedy, for instance, because of the equity question, they have about 67 people doing the work that would be paid by, we would actually have 74 people to do that work, and so when you stretch, I mean, if SDSD was doing it, they would have 74, but the AAA picked up 67. So each of those people picking up extra case load, therefore they make some errors. But so even if we could answer the equity thing, we might get to the point of reducing the error rate.
Senator
Fisher. Thank you, Is this also the part of the problem that I recall, it seemed like it was with this issue, was the fact that if someone's income changed, even though you couldn't have known about it in advance, in retrospect, you made an error?
I'm sure, Senator Fisher, that's part of it, right, mm-hmm. that their income changes either plus or minus. And I think Representative Loken actually asked me a question, what if they make less? Let's still put it narrowly, too. So that's tied up in it. But as we pointed out in our memo to John, there are also places where we just simply we knew the information didn't apply and didn't apply it correctly.
Like, according to John, when he said the formula about error, it sounded to me like a bunch of hocus pocus. You have two cases, and you make two errors, that's 100%. But he's given some wonky percentage here based on how much it was over or under. Can you go over that again? It's like you try to get a handle on what they're actually basing it on.
Madam Chair and Senator Fisher, the example I gave was a two-case situation where mistakes were made on both cases, but and the total amount adjudicated was about $1,000 in benefits. And on one, and this is hypothetical, of course, they estimated that the benefit should have been $100 too high. On the other one, it was $100 too low. So, in effect, both cases were wrong. That's true. But the error rate is adding 100 over plus the 100 under for, to get 200, and then dividing it by the total dollar amount adjudicated. So it's a 20% error rate.
But I also, actually, I'd like, John, for you to explain who else has to fall under these rules and why just simply saying you know, I mean, all of these error rates are judged the same throughout the country. It's no different in Oregon than it is anywhere else. Everybody has the same rules. And so if...
Madam Chair, you've explained it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not... Every other place in the country has to abide by these rules, too. So if they're getting a lower error rate, obviously they're doing a better job of looking at it.
And here are they?
Yes, they are. Where are we in the country? We're pretty bad.
Well, certainly, Madam Chair, Senator Fisher, we're Roger, for the record, Roger Auer, Vaccine and Disabled Services Division. We are below, I mean, our error rate is higher than the rest of the country, and that's why the federal government has come in and basically said that they wanted us to do something to bring our error rate down. It's just, I mean, I can't say exactly where we are on the list, but we are sufficiently higher than the national average enough for them to come in and say that you need to do something about it. And this is why over the past couple of years we've been spending time and investment in working with and sending experts in. And I mean, one of the things that we're doing is we're trying to teach people shortcuts. We're trying to get experts in the field to say, you know, the workforce that is actually reviewing the eligibility cases, there is in fact a higher workload. In 1995, there was a reduction in the amount of growth of our staff, and we ended up with a higher caseload, which is a fact. But we also have quite a bit of turnover in this segment of our workforce, and this is a lot of them. I think about 50% of our workforce has been there a year or less. So this is also what we think is the reason why we need to continue to again, get experts in and to do as much one-on-one training as possible.
Madam Chair, I think we understand your instruction and the concern with this recommendation. And you know, if the committee moves forward with it, we'll proceed to do everything possible to reduce the error rate, just as we have done on the AFS plan.
Okay.
We understand where you want to go.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the final item on the reshoot that we are not recommending be funded is the spousal pay increase over the governor's recommended budget of $0.8 million. I'd like to combine the discussion on that with the second point, which is a further recommended reduction on the spousal pay program of $2.6 million in general fund. When the $0.8 million is added to the printed governor's recommended budget, we have a spousal pay program of about $7 million total general fund. As was mentioned in the rebalance discussion, this is not a Medicaid reimbursable program. The state is picking up the entire cost of the program, all $7 million. In 99-01, the program was funded, and this is the $7 million, to fund about 232 cases. That averages about $1,266 a month. What I've done in terms of reducing or making these recommendations to reduce the budget by a total of $3.4 million is that I talked to SDSC about the cost if this were a Medicaid reimbursable program. Now, initially, SDSC told me that the cost would be about between $300 and $400 higher, and I'll talk about that for a second. I have taken the $1,266, increased it by $350, multiplied that by the 232 cases to get a cost of about $9 million, and then said, what's the general fund share of that program if it's about 40%, which is the state share of the Medicaid program. And that's how the reduction was made. It was designed to say, look, we could serve these people with a client, employed provider, a live-in person. This is what it would cost, roughly. Now, since that time, there have been a couple of things that have developed. One is that FDSC looked at these cases a little more carefully. They received information that roughly half of those that were reviewed would require nursing facilities were it not for the spousal pay program, which would indicate that I may have overestimated the savings. The other piece of information that came to light was that FDSC has applied for an independent choices waiver program. The waiver program would essentially be a voucher program whereby eligible clients, Medicaid eligible clients, would be given a voucher that was the cost of the least costly plan, and then they could spend it any way that they chose to spend it. The waiver does not allow for spousal pay. It's in fact, the application that FDSC gave the federal government over a year ago specifically says that this will not be used for spousal pay cases. However, at the same time, FDSC is saying that they believe that we believe that a high percentage of spousal pay clients would be interested in the option. And then they say there is no guarantee that all spousal pay clients will choose to become part of the demonstration. So in other words, this may have the effect, if FDSC is right, of reducing the spousal pay caseload somewhat. To what degree, I don't know, and I don't think they do either. I must say that the waiver has not yet been granted. It is in the apparently final review with the Office of Management and Budget, having already proceeded through Healthcare Financing Administration. Do you have questions on the spousal pay reduction?
Spousal pay increase over 0.8 million, and does that mean that we are leaving 0.8 million in the spousal pay?
It means that actually we're leaving about $3.6 million in the spousal pay program.
Okay, and so.
Granted, if Representative Ross, if this were a $7 million program and you took a 40% match, you're looking at about $2.8 million in general fund. The increase above the 2.8 to the 3.4, I guess is what I said, 3.6, represent that increase in cost of about $350 per case. So you're right, this recommendation is not to eliminate the spousal pay, but it is, frankly, to cut it back significantly,
okay, and
to reduce it.
So the remaining amount would be 3.6?
Correct. That's
and right. The amount of the cut would be?
The amount of the reduction would be the $0.8 million that
okay.
and the 2.6, so 3.4 total reduction.
Okay, good. That's what I was thinking. Oh, okay, good, all right. Okay, so the amount of the cut is 3.4, but there is 3.6 remaining in the program, and
that's right.
So that it's really up to the division to manage this money prudently in a way that it can be used for the cases where this is most appropriate or most needed or where other alternatives are not available. Is that
Madam
that
Chair correct? And Representative Ross, that's correct.
Because there are going to be Representative Heat, and he also, John also told us about a waiver program that is really quite a ways through the process on this last leg of getting approval. It's gone through HIPAA, I understand.
It's been through all the HICPA approvals. It's now at the Office of Management and Budget. So it's just the budget neutrality issue is what we have to convince the federal government about.
What might be the timeline on the waiver?
I, Representative Roth, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Senator Shields. Madam Chair, as you know, you and I talked about this one a little bit this morning.
We did.
So I tried to find a little more information about it. How many of these are retirement elderly, and how many are younger disabled clients? You know?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, about 82% are under the age of 65 of the client.
Okay, follow-up. I've heard that this would eliminate 232 clients. How many would be named?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, the entire caseload is 232, so this would not eliminate the entire caseload.
Okay, so what I got was not quite accurate. I've indicated that I have some real concerns about this one, and have heard that a lot of them are terminally ill cases, and that others are severe, like spinal cord injuries and stuff like that, where you have a spouse doing the kinds of things that the other spouse might not really be very comfortable having a CET come in to do, you know, the very personal kinds of stuff. And so I have some concerns at that level as well.
Senator Shields, as I said, we had the discussion, and I won't go there, but as was indicated, 82% of that caseload are not retirement age, and the fact that there is money left in the budget for the spousal reimbursement, I think one of the areas that you had stated you wanted to protect, for instance, was an elderly woman in your district who is watching her husband, who she's 75, she can't go to work, and this would this helps her a great deal, and it's those kinds of cases I'm hoping that FDFC will be able to look at and continue to fund.
Can I have a question about flexibility if they have the staff or the department representative?
I think so.
Okay. I wanted to ask about your flexibility in targeting the funds that are left. In other words, there's some cases where another person can be found and brought in, or another solution can be found. There's some cases in which the spouse is really the very most appropriate and cost-effective person. Will you have flexibility to target these funds, target the cases that, in your judgment, need it the most, or are you hamstrung by eligibility requirements and limited in your choices?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, we're sort of struggling here with the recommendation because we don't quite understand how this works. I mean, what you're leaving in the program is the money that will go, and correct me with you, Mr. Britton, if I'm wrong, but what you're leaving as general fund is the money that's necessary to match the federal fund, which will then employ client-employed providers. Did I understand, Madam Chair, that
is correct in part. Again, if this budget were funded at 40%, if we had a $7 million total cost, and Mr. Weeks is right, that's not the cost that I'm calculating as the Medicaid cost, the higher cost, then he would be right that what's left in the budget would cover the Medicaid substitute for this program. At the same time, I think what you said earlier, that is, if there are unique cases where this needs to happen and there are no alternatives at all, this is not a recommendation to completely cut the spousal pay program, but it is to reduce it. That is correct.
But Madam Chair, Representative Ross, with due respect, if we're supposed to employ client-employed providers for these people, and we need the general fund match that's left to do it, what are we going to use to employ the spouses? Because the CEPs are going to do all this work. And I guess I still don't understand how you can make that, and I have to make this recommendation work, and it doesn't work out to me, but the direct answer to your question is, if we go the CEP route, we've got 232 families here who, July 1, we've got to find client-employed providers for. Client-employed providers who will work 24 hours a day, live in, and who have skills or to deal with profoundly disabled folks and seniors. And, I mean, we don't have 232 families.
Why, Gary, why would you have to find a 24-hour-a-day client provider if there is a spouse and that spouse lives in that house and is there at least at night?
And I'm sure then you want us to, if there's a spouse, then you want us to make a distinction and not let them have a CEP for 24 hours?
If we are reimbursing that spouse for doing this work, and in turn we're going to, yes, we are. If they're under this program, we are paying them to do it.
Prospectively, then, I'm sure. I'm thinking about the recommendation from staff. We wouldn't be reimbursing the spouse.
Right, and Medicaid doesn't allow for us to reimburse the spouse, but we happen to have a program that does that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are going to provide for this person who is the spouse, who's now being repaid or being paid by the state to do this, we're going to allow the spouse now to have a client-employed provider.
Mm-hmm.
But since the spouse is there and has been giving this care, it's very possible they won't need the care for 24 hours.
It's possible. I agree, Madam Chair. But I guess I'm more concerned about fundamentally how we make this work if we need all the general funds left to match the federal funds. And I just want you to know what you're going into. I mean, it's basically that we're going to give up health care for the most part and switch to client-employed providers.
Do you know why Medicaid doesn't reimburse spousal care? Do you have any idea?
Madam Chair, I don't.
Roger?
Mr. Auerbach.
Madam Chair, from what we've heard over the years is that Medicaid does not want to reimburse spousal care because they're afraid of fraud. It's just a question of they believe that this program will be abused, and this is why very, very candidly, Madam Chair, we have made this a very restricted program. This program is very, very small. Of all of our long-term care systems, this represents 0.6% of our total long-term care system. So we have made it so we don't pay spouses for the types of things that they would do because they're a spouse. We don't pay for all that period of time at night. We pay them for the period of time that we would ordinarily have a client-employed provider in.
I guess I need to understand then why $1,266 a month is what a spouse gets paid and an additional $350 is what somebody who's a client-employed provider that is Medicaid reimbursed or matched is paid. Where is the difference? Where is those other hours? Where are those other hours?
Sorry, Madam Chair, it's generally for the live-in part of a client-employed provider because we pay at a much lesser rate for client-employed providers on a 24-hour basis. For spouses, you don't pay for that 24-hour care. That's something we've built into the program, and that's why the average cost for spousal care is less, and again, we estimated between $300 and $400 a month less than it would be for a client-employed provider, because we don't pay for those hours. But exactly the same reasons that you're saying that we have some expectations of spouses, and we should, and that's the way the program is built.
Senator, Chair, you asked Roger about fraud in this 232 cases. Have you discovered much fraud? I mean, that's what. The federal government is worried about. That's why they don't pay spouses. And we found fraud here.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I want to know if this is.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. The short answer is no. But it's also, again, this is not an option. This is an option that sort of comes very far down the list for us. Again, a very impaired person with a spouse who is able, and again, somebody who's very, very impaired, and this looks like it's the most appropriate option, because if we went for trying to get a client employed provider, first of all, you know that recruitment has been hard and continues to be hard for client employed providers. And secondarily, especially if you need a live-in, if you need a live-in client employed provider, you're going to need an extra bedroom. So if someone lives in a one-bedroom apartment and you start to look at the need for a client employed provider live-in, then you're going to have to change the housing setting for this person. Very restrictive program, Senator.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Yee.
Gary, you're saying that after the cut, the money is used to match federal money in order to pay for this program. And you want to see some flexibility where we can still pay the spousal support officers.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I was just reacting to what I thought was a sense that you might all be having, that of the money left, there would be money for spousal support. And we don't believe there is. We believe that what's left will be needed to match the federal funds. So I'm not urging you to put additional money in. I just want to make sure you understood that there isn't going to be a separate pot for spousal support. It's the current program, the general funded program. Just a point of clarification.
So the money will all go into to match and pay for the client and employee
provider.
So there's no money for spousal support at all?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Yee, again, the way that I calculated the reduction was by assuming a $350 cost increase per case. And I guess from the questions that have been asked here, I wonder if that's appropriate, in as much as it sounds as though if a spouse is at home during the night, it may not be necessary to hire a live-in provider, which was my understanding that this $350 increase would take care of. That is to say that in most instances, a spouse would go to work, and for the time that spouse is at work, SDSC would hire a client employed provider and pay for those hours in particular where there is no spouse at home available. Now, whether that piece is taken care of with the $350 or whether it doesn't cost that much, I'm not altogether sure. But if it were restricted to the hours of the time when a spouse is being employed, it's a guess, and I'd have to verify this with SDSD as to whether the real cost would be as high as we thought it would be. And if it wasn't, then there would be a few, not a lot, but there would be some dollars left for the spousal pay. But that, admittedly, is not the way I calculated the reduction.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm missing the boat here.
Because it was my understanding at the beginning that you were just reducing this amount by the match.
Yes.
That we were losing.
And Madam Chair, Representative Ross, the way I calculated was that this was a $7 million program for 232 cases.
Right.
The cost per case was $1,266.
Uh-huh.
Then, in asking SDSC what would it cost to have a client employed provider do the same thing, they said that it would cost between $300 and $400 more a month per case. So I took $350, added it to the $1,266 to get a monthly cost of $1,616.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Then I used that to get to a roughly $9 million Medicaid cost,
mm-hmm.
40% of which would be the state general fund match.
Mm-hmm.
what this discussion may call into question is the increase in the cost of the $350. That is to say, if a spouse went to work and we had a client employed provider during the, just during the hours that the spouse was at work, I'm not sure it would cost $1,616 to you. But I'm not, I wouldn't swear either way on that.
But let me try to ask my question. After we made this reduction and the money that's left, the 3.6, are you saying that the department would have the flexibility to either pay a smaller amount or fewer hours to the spouse if that seemed the wisest thing, or would they all have to go to client employee assistance?
Well, again, Mr. Weeks is correct. The way I calculated this, they would all have to go to a Medicaid eligible kind of program, reimbursable program.
Right.
If that cost of $350 is too high or could be avoided, there would be some, maybe not a lot, but there would be some dollars available for spouses, spousal pay in very, very unique cases where that was judged to be a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I share Senator Shields' concern over this in terms of the net savings, especially if some of these people, the family just gives up and says, well, go take the person to a nursing home. So some of these cases we'd have to pay more for because of that situation. But also from the compassion point of view, that some of these people have 6 months of dying and the spouse may be the most appropriate. And what I was struggling for was to be sure that we had some flexibility within a limited amount of money to provide that when the circumstances justified it.
Let me find out
if that was the case.
Madam Chair and Representative Ross, let me respond also by saying that this is showing, this particular program is showing significant caseload change. Again, the current biennium was spending about $4.6 million, and then that went up to $7 million. That was what this reduction was based on, was $7 million total. That's not the entire increase, but I'm just looking at this. There's about a $2.4 million general fund increase from the current level of spending to the next biennium. About 1.6 of that is caseload growth of 52 cases, so up from 180 to 232.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator
Shields?
I realize that we've spent a lot of time on this, but one final question I would have, and I appreciate John going through the system again, because I'm actually wondering if we would end up saving any money in the long run if a lot of these people have to change their living arrangements and some of them go to nursing homes and stuff like that, and if others people have to move from like one bedroom apartments, like Roger was saying, to two bedroom apartments to accommodate a 24 hour CDT. I really wonder if we'd save any money in the final analysis, and that's all done.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I think that's a reasonable question to ask me. And I'd say that those, that the two instances where you cited that could increase cost pressure, that is, that some of these people would go into nursing facilities, as well as some people needing a larger home to accommodate a live-in provider. Again, I have questions about whether they would need a live-in provider, but I think that those are reasonable questions to ask. At the same time, the waiver, which may take some burden off of this particular program and promote more choices for some of these people who are on spousal pay, that's another unknown quantity as well. It may go the other way. So I don't know how it would all turn out.
Representative Gilbert.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to keep belaboring this, but let me ask a question. Maybe you guys can answer. What is the
eligibility standard for determining whether a spouse gets paid or not. I assume that there's a lot more than 232 spouses caring for other spouses in their home, so why do we pay only those 232 and not everyone?
Madam Chair, Representative Schobeck, for the record, Roger Auerbach, I have the rules in front of me, which actually talk about...
Can you just summarize?
Well, I mean, yes.
you don't
want to hear all the administrative rules. First of all, the impairment level has to be higher than you know, 4 out of 6 activities of daily living they have to need assistance with. They have to either have a medically diagnosed progressive debilitating condition or to have a spinal cord injury. So, I mean, there are, in fact, the impairment level is really the biggest issue in determining, you know, the spousal pay, the ability to get into the spousal pay program. But it's also has a lot to do whether in fact that works for the spouse and also works for the client. So it's not every spouse that wants to be at home in the entire workday and evening time taking care of their spouse. So it doesn't work always for all clients, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that the determining factor generally is a pretty heavy impairment level.
So then it sounds like it's an elective program. If you meet the qualifications, you can choose to be in or out.
Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, I mean, it is, but, I mean, again, this is not a program which we mention to everybody who's in this situation because it doesn't work for all clients. When we're talking about a placement for a new client, this is something that we would bring up and we would talk about if, in fact, they met the criteria. So, yes, I guess, in effect, if they meant the requirements of the program, they could elect to be in.
And if they elected not to be in, they would get an outside provider anyway, right?
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
I wanted to follow up. So it sounds to me like in some of these cases, it's not a matter of whether the spouse wants to take care of them or not. It sounds like this is an income issue.
Madam Chair, Representative Schobeck, I mean, I think there's a lot of factors that go into it because, there's obviously lots of trade-offs between what somebody, you know, would get paid for staying home and taking care of a dependent spouse. And, again, this is something that we don't delve into, but, in fact, if it works for them and, in fact, the person is capable of providing proper care for that client, and they meet the test, they in fact can choose this option.
Do you have any more?
No.
One of the questions that kind of comes to my mind with this level of questioning here is, can this couple, the spouse being paid to care for the other couple, for the other person, are they allowed to get CET to come in for some heavy lifting or some other things right now? Does a spouse get paid their spousal care, as well as do they ever have payment for a fine employed provider? Mm-hmm. So this 75 or 80-year-old woman who's taking care of her spouse is able to lift this person and completely take care of this spouse without any help?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, in fact, one of the things in the rule that we look at is if the spouse is able to take care of those 6 activities of daily living. So, in fact, if it requires heavy lifting, we are going to say to that spouse who's 75 years old, you can't do this. You cannot do this because you are not able to take care of your spouse as much as you'd like to. You need not to be with this program. You need to be mm-hmm. with a client employed provider program. Because I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I mean, it's in very clearly in the rules that they have to demonstrate the capability and health to provide the service.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that does clarify that. But I would also go back to what Representative Strobeck sort of alluded to the question that he raised. Is it an income issue? Because part of what I was told in, about this whole program is that a spouse quits their job so that they can take care of their spouse. And, with this sort of a program,
mm-hmm.
the spouse could go back to work and have a client-employed provider come in and do that care during the day for them, make their income, maybe, I would think, more,
yes.
probably, than what they're getting paid
yes.
to care for their spouse.
Yes.
And they still would have an opportunity to spend time with their spouse.
That's right.
So.
I agree.
Representative Loken, did you have a question? You had one earlier, but
I was wondering if this voucher plan comes in and eventually approves waivers, does that take the place then of this spousal program? Would that be the intent?
Madam Chair and Representative Loken, I don't believe that it is the intent. Again, the waiver does not allow for spousal pay, but it does allow, and I might clarify this too, this is a waiver for three sites within Oregon, maximum of 100 cases at each site for the voucher, what I'm calling a voucher program, but the Independent Choices Program. But SDSC believes that some of the spousal cases may be interested in this option.
Okay, let's move on.
Madam Chair, just for clarification, are we reducing the caseload from 235 to 180?
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, not necessarily. I would say yes for the spousal pay. We are making a reduction in the spousal pay program. And under the spousal pay program, the caseload would be reduced significantly, as I have come to understand it. But the overall caseload for SDSC would hopefully not be changed significantly by doing this.
Okay, let's move on. Point three.
Point three is the Medicare upper limit payment. Ms. Archer of the Legislative Fiscal Office explained this a little bit in the rebalance because we had to do some work on making or adding expenditure limitation to DHR's budget to make this particular payment. This is another payment that will be made. As I've listed on here, it's an initial payment to 9 public hospital districts of roughly $40 million, $39.9 million general fund or other funds, and the department hasn't yet figured out exactly how much of each, and $59.5 million of federal funds. The payment is made to these 9 public hospital districts, and they in turn make a payment back to the state it would be the total of these two amounts less about $8.5 million. And the $8.5 million is a payment to the public hospital districts. This was a package that the governor and his staff worked out with the public hospital districts and various associations, and this does not represent any kind of change from that package deal that was put together by the governor. Two pieces of the money that is coming back to the state, these are two ways that it will be spent. Our nursing facility rebase restoration, this is about $6.6 million state funds. Again, we're not sure whether they will be general fund or other funds for sure. I think they will be general funds, but we will get the final mechanism and the exact dollar figures from the department when they are finished with their work. And as along with community-based rates increased by about $3.2 million state funds. Again, this is part of an overall package that the governor put together. Do you have questions?
Any
about
questions from the Senator Field?
I'm sure.
Oh, okay. Senator Fisher.
Yeah, it's a particularly frustrating situation here when you couple it with four. Simply because you're saying in three, the third bullet, you recognize the rates need to be increased, which we recognize easily. And the process for the last two, three bienniums or more. And so now we're saying, well, we recognize that they're not enough. Now we're going to add a little something to it. And we turn right around and say, whoops, so we're just going to create another hole in another part of your pocket and drain out almost all of it. And regardless of how you cut it, whether you talk about an impairment reduction or what you do, it's merely putting $3.2 million and taking $2.7 back. You got $500,000 there, basically, that you're better off than you were before, which...
Senator, could we wait until the impairment is actually explained? We're right now we're on the upper limit. The actual backfill of the 6.6 and the 3.2 and the other dollars, and we'll get to the fourth bullet or number four in a minute. I'd rather have staff explain that prior to you bringing up the issue of holes. If we could. Are there any questions?
I need you to get along with today.
Okay, thank you. I need it. Senator.
Okay. So are we putting in 39.9 general fund and we get 59.5 million federal funds back?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, not quite. We're getting the whole bit back, the 39.9 plus the 59.5, less about $8.5 million, which is the payment to the public nursing home or the public hospital district.
So we put in 40, we get $100 million back?
Yes, roughly.
And then we...
Left that $8.5 million.
So we get $1.5 million back.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, correct.
And then we restore $6.6 million and $3.2 million.
Right.
So
the 90... Madam Chair and Senator Yee, the 90-plus million dollars that we net from this particular mechanism...
Right.
Will be used in a lot of different ways, as far as I know. And I don't know all the ways that it will be used. However, we know that about $9.8 million of that, 90-plus million, will be used in two ways. One is for the restoration of the nursing facility rebase and community-based or the community-based facility rate increase.
Right. So, Madam Chair,
Senator, the question is,
what do we do with the remaining $81.7 million?
Senator Yee, we will get to that when we get to those budgets.
Oh, because can we use some of that?
No. No, it's
a division.
It's actually something that has been agreed upon with the governor and with DHR and a lot of people with input, and we had to get agreement so that everybody would actually go through with this. But we are not dealing with every bit of this money in this particular budget, and I think what our staff is trying to show us is what we're going to gain, but for this particular budget, this is how we're using a portion of it. But we will come to the rest of it later, and it is all being used.
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, I might add that the Department of Human Resources will not have a net reduction of their general fund spending power, if you will. The idea here is that they will come out whole, if you will. That is, that the $39.9 million general fund or other fund expenditure will ultimately end up back in their budget, if that makes sense.
I thought we have some excess, but I think the chair just answered my question.
Yeah, I wish we did. I wish we did. Or these people wouldn't be here wondering what in the heck we're doing here today. Senator Shields.
Could John explain more carefully, for me at least, maybe for others on the committee, what the community base rate increase of $3.2 million does? I mean,
yeah.
Does it help? How does it help?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, this is geared towards community-based facilities, namely assisted living facilities, adult foster care homes, and residential care facilities. It does not include client-employed providers. And it would give those facilities rate increases of about 4% each year during the biennium. I think it's a total of 8.3% during the entire biennium. And the amount was derived simply by looking at the nursing facility rebate, calculating a percentage increase in those rates, and trying to match it. So in other words, it was attempting to give community-based facilities the same increase as the nursing facility increase.
Okay. Further questions about this? Number three. If not, we'll move on to number four.
Number four is the one that Senator Fisher will begin to question.
Yes.
Sure. This is an impairment piece of the governor's recommended budget. It's a reduction of about $2.7 million general fund. The overall impairment amount included in the initial budget of SCSD and their agency request budget was about twice this, about 5.4. The governor's recommended budget eliminated half of the impairment amount. This recommendation would remove the other half of the impairment amount. And I would acknowledge on the outset that there is evidence to suggest that within community-based facilities, there is some growing impairment. I looked at the 17 survival priority levels and the distribution within the community-based facilities of those clients, and it appears from the 95-97 biennium to the current biennium to the projection for the next biennium that there is some amount of impairment increase. Having said that, however, I think that the way that this was calculated by SCSD was not persuasive to me anyhow. This was the notion of having a Department of Administrative Services inflation level and saying, well, our costs are going up faster than that inflation level, so the difference in cost increase is impairment. And I'm not persuaded particularly by that argument. And anyway, that's the basis for this reduction in part. The other, as Senator Fisher already pointed out, is that the community-based rates are increasing by about $3.2 million state funds through the Medicare upper limit mechanism. So overall, we are increasing their rates above the governor's recommended budget by about $0.5 million.
Actually, I'll let Senator Fisher now talk, now that it's been explained.
Well, I guess.
Comment.
John said he's not persuaded. I guess I was just going the other side. I'm not persuaded. It bothers me. Again, reaching all these agreements over the bones of and the ills and the woes of everybody else, we don't even get down to talking about $1 million or $2 million when it comes to education or something like that. We talk in terms of giving an extra $100 million or $500 million or something like this, and then we can't spare $1 million or two to help out. If this 3.2 were doubled, it still wouldn't put wages up where they ought to be for those folks. And so I'll let it go at that. It's just
very frustrating to me to see the line of what we're taking here in the way of funding. We've got people that are holding out. They can't seem to come to using the money that we have, which is a goodly sum. This is more than what we had 2 years ago. And if we split those extra monies up evenly or even approaching evenly amongst the needs, you wouldn't be hearing many comments about me about not supporting budgets. But in any event, I'll hold my piece of that statement.
And Senator, I'm not
accusing you. I know you.
I know. No, and I was going to say.
You'll be half.
I know.
Because I know that you've been handed something that you're not happy with. And you've tried to do the best that you can. I appreciate that. And
I just would like to comment, too, that this is very difficult for me. And I hope that every person out here that has a sign on their chest with an axe on it will go, and I mean it, go to the Education Committee when they are hearing the K-12 budget. You are singing to the choir here. What you need to do is go and convince our colleagues that this budget balancing is happening where it need not be happening. So, with that, Senator Shields.
Yes, a minute ago, John, you said that with the 3.3, the rate increase would be 4% per year. If you back up to 2.6, what will the rate increase then be?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Shields, I think that's a good question because, as I understand it, the rates would be increased by the $3.2 million state funds. The impairment was to be used and is used, at least that's my understanding that it's used to provide for a particular client, for example, who would move up in a rate tier or within the rate tier for adult foster homes or assisted living. That is, they become more impaired and they shift up the rate ladder or down the rate ladder, but the rate increases to accommodate their higher impairment level. So my understanding is from this that the rates would increase. However, there would not be additional dollars allocated to the budget to accommodate increasing impairment.
Madam Chair, explain this to me a little bit, what we're talking about with rates of impairment. I mean, if you go into a adult foster care, is that what we're talking about, going into a foster care or a nursing home?
As I understand it, Representative Locum and Madam Chair, in an adult foster home, there are 5 rate levels.
Okay.
And as you become more impaired as a client, the idea is to pay the provider more to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all part of what SDSC has termed aging in place. That is, that we're not going to take a person out of a assisted living facility or adult foster home facility and move them into a nursing home. We try to avoid that, and we try to accommodate their increasing impairment through a rate structure that pays more for higher impairment.
Mm-hmm. Additional questions.
Okay, Representative Locum.
So if a person then, are we saying then that as their care needs increase, the cost increases because we have to have more people taking care of them or because they have to go into a different type of facility?
Madam Chair and Representative Locum, it's not that they have to go into a different kind of facility. It is that their care and service requirements are more expensive as they become more impaired. Now, eventually, and we have the caseload for SDSC is a dynamic one.
Mm-hmm.
People are leaving the caseload through death.
Mm-hmm.
People are going on to the caseload because of impairment and all kinds of situations. As I said earlier, I am persuaded that there is some overall of the total portfolio of clients, there is some indication to say, yes, there is some increasing impairment.
Mm-hmm.
But how that translates into dollars, I'm not willing to accept at least the method that SDSC put forth to arrive at the $5.4 million.
Well, I guess I wonder if it requires another person to take care, or if we're just, are we talking about additional medications, possible medication? Because it would seem to me if the same person is going, maybe a person does get more ill, but it would still be one person probably taking care of that person, wouldn't it, in a home? So I don't know where you'd have an additional cost for the care, but I can see probably in the medication and that type of service where there would be more.
Madam Chair and Representative Loken, I think that certainly if we look at an assisted living facility, there are more than, obviously more than one staff person, and that's also true in adult foster homes in many instances, not always, but in many instances. And if a person becomes more impaired who is living in an assisted living facility, it might require more staff time or more hours to care for them as they become more impaired.
Okay. For instance, somebody may, and hopefully I'm saying the right thing. I think I understand it, and I'll say this. For instance, somebody might not have been incontinent,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, through half the year, they become incontinent. Mm-hmm. So that is an additional duty that's taken on by one of the workers that are there, and because that duty is taken on, of course, that takes a little bit more of the time. So if there's more of those folks in the facility, then that means that there is additional time.
Mm-hmm.
Gary, did you want to?
I'm sure I just want one point of clarification for the committee, and that is the amount that's in the upper limits proposal, $3.2 million. You remember that initially was intended to go to wages, and Co-Chair Lewis in our conversation had real concerns about can we assure that that's going to go to wages
mm-hmm.
and not somewhere else. And we said, we'll do everything we can to assure it goes to wages because we have impairment costs already built in. Now, just so you know what's going to happen here is that $3.2 million is going to slide over now and be used by these facilities to cover impairment costs because there are going to be impairments. I mean, for John to say there is some evidence of impairment increases, like, or the doctor saying you may find some discomfort in this procedure. I mean, that's one of my favorite things. Because you know it's going to happen. And I don't fault the facilities. They have to do it. And your example was a very good one. They will have to take care of the incontinence that it incurs. So they'll slide the $3.2 million to cover the impairment side. And the wage side that we were trying to get won't happen. And that will just further break apart our community-based care. I understand what you're trying to do. I just want to make sure everybody knows you don't feel like we've told you that wages were going to go up, and then later on we say they didn't go up, and you want to know why. So.
Madam Chair, can I make just one more, two more comments, one on this. What you really have, you have an inflation that takes place through the monetary system, but we also have an inflation taking place in the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do they live longer now, but they have a potential for higher needs of care for a longer period of time. So you have, let's see, different medications and different things that we've learned and the ways of taking care of folks and combating pneumonias and things like this. We have kept them alive longer at a higher need of help when they get to that point. And so from that standpoint, you caught kind of the whole saying between a rock and a hard place because it just happens. And I can tell you that specifically. In the nursing home, we don't have probably 5 patients out of our average caseload of around 150, 175 people that would have been there 30 years ago when I started. They're all way above that, requiring all kinds of further things. These would have been hospitalized cases before, probably might not even been around because of the techniques and things that we've known now, they would have long been gone. But it poses a real problem, and to go back to some of the things that we discussed here about problems with the faults and the things with the AAAs on the when we were discussing the food stamp program. If we had errors like that in our care and stuff like that, I mean, we'd just be shut down.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't operate like that. You know, we just don't be able to fix it, and it doesn't really make any difference how the cost goes or anything else. We have to fix those programs. We can't have 20% mistakes and 20% worth of errors and all this kind of an error ratio and stuff in our care. And it makes it really, really tough to do that, and that's why we said that. But I just got appointed to the sub on education, so please.
No, they after, need to come.
After, you know, on that, I will tell the same song and dance over there, but you also need to stop at our friend, the governor's office.
Yeah, that's
but you're going out and you're purposely inflating something for another area of the governmental budget, and you're doing it without thought to how much money we have in the overall budget. It's not right. And believe me, we need some help in those areas too, because to go out and to offer some things to somebody that basically can't be reached without violating pledges and promises to the taxpayer and things like this, it just makes havoc in trying to work budgets out here. Just stop and think, well, just the interest for a few days on the money that's being proposed extra in the educational field, but just the interest on that for a few days would just do as a one-time help in some of these budgets here. Well, that, Madam Chair, for so nobody makes a mistake, I'm going to declare a potential conflict of interest in this because I do own and operate a nursing home, and we'll be potentially having some of the funds that we're dealing with here as well to pay for the care that we give.
Representative Loken?
I just have one more thing, and I know I'm kind of playing a devil's advocate as much because I need some answers and information and understanding, but as we talk about impairment and aging and people getting sicker and then kind of moving out either probably through death or would be the usual thing, I suppose. But does that balance off at all with younger folks coming in or those that are less impaired? Is there a balancing that goes on here? Because then their costs would be lower.
And so Representative Loken, I think there is probably some balancing, but as Senator Fisher's pointed out, these folks at the upper end are living
going up higher.
You know, and then the new ones that are entering. So there is some trade-offs there.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they're living longer. And I guess what disappoints me most about this is that it appears that we're getting this recommendation because we didn't do a good job of explaining how impairment ought to be calculated and stuff. I mean, and I'm sorry that we didn't do that good a job, and I'm disappointed by it. I wish we'd had another opportunity, but that's what John's saying is he wasn't convinced we needed impairment, even though we all recognize that there are impairment changes in every client over the years. Some are small and don't require any. Mm-hmm. Others are larger and will require.
Well, and even when they do require a little bit of something, this is where I think actually the $3.2 million that we're putting into some of the wages and the people that are in the foster care and assisted living
mm-hmm.
will actually help to balance out some of these impairment needs. If they are being paid a little bit more, they might be willing to take on some of the more. Now, that's not to say that we can continually go on here without impairment costs being realized or funded in that sense. But in a sense, I still could see that these could go to wages, and these, because they are increasing, they are receiving a higher wage, they would be more willing and able to take on a little bit of impairment. Now, granted, this cannot
mm-hmm.
go on, for a long time, because I mean, it's obvious that you do need it, but there are puts and takes, I think, and so if we're done with this section, we'll go to number five. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess we went. Representative Ross and Representative. That's right.
John, right at the end of your first explanation before we got into questions on this issue, I understood you to say that we were adding $5 million more to this system. Did I miss what you said, or could you
Madam Chair, Representative
more?
Ross, what I hope to have said was that the agency request added $5.4 million. The governor's recommended budget removed half. This is removing the remaining amount.
Okay, and so all we have left in the community-based system was the increase in rates that was really intended for wages.
Madam Chair and Representative Ross, correct.
Do we also get increases for expected caseload expansion?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, yes. And in fact, some of that expansion or contraction took place in the reshoot.
Okay, so that's accurate, they figured. Okay. John, recognizing that there is some impairment increase, even if they haven't calculated exactly right, and what Representative Loken has right, that some people come in at lower level of care, and that balances off some of those folks. What is your expectation about how they would absorb the rest of the extra care that some of these people would is it your idea that the community, is it your idea?
That's nursing home too, which
Okay.
What is your idea about how that would be absorbed?
Madam Chair and Representative Ross, my assumption is, and I think Mr. Weeks explained that the rate would be increased, but that they would not have additional funds to accommodate impairment. That the 3.3 or 3.2 was earmarked for wage increases. And what Mr. Weeks is arguing is that they wouldn't use it for increases. They would use it to accommodate impairment. I think Senator Kutub then said, well, maybe there's a combination there. Maybe we can combine them in some way.
Thank you. Representative Strobeck.
I just want to ask about the $3.9 million federal funds. You've talked a lot about the 5.4 request. What is that, 3.9? Is that some sort of a match deal?
Representative Strobeck, that's the match. What's the Medicaid match component?
That we will lose.
Yeah, but let me back up. The community-based care, the 3.2, is just the state portion as well. There is, for both the nursing facility rebase restoration and the community-based rate increase, Medicaid match with those as well on a 60-40 ratio, roughly.
Okay.
Now.
So it's not, in other words, a substitute of $3.2 million for 2.7 general and 3.9 federal. That is not the case. Madam Chair, may I continue?
Yes.
Okay. The fifth point on this list is to accept the DHR 4% reductions. This is $2.1 million of general fund, $2.1 million of federal funds. There are five components of this cut. The first is to reduce services and supplies, including delay replacing computers, reduce travel, to federally mandated training programs, reduce funds for the Attorney General. This reduction would generate about $0.8 million of general fund savings. The second bullet is reduce temporary staff by 20%, 97,000 general fund savings. Hold central office positions vacant 4 months instead of 2 months. $65,000 general fund savings. Reduce facilities maintenance by 75%, $164,000 general fund. And finally, delay hiring additional workload, increase staff by 8 months. And let me address that last point. In the DHR reshoot, which we are accepting, there are overall caseload increases, particularly in the community-based care side of FDS's Medicaid program. And along with that, there are about 29 new FTE that would be distributed to both
the AAAs as well as SDSU's staff. This last point would delay that FTE or delay the implementation of those new staff by about eight months. And that would generate about $1 million of general fund savings.
Okay, so just quick clarification there. So when would we be hiring those new people about?
8 months into the biennium.
Okay. So
about March.
Okay.
They could be hired by March of 2000.
And there is some flexibility. They have some earlier and some later to balance out.
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Lee, and how many people are we talking about delay hiring?
Let me check that.
This is within the department?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, no, they are not all within the department. Some of them are in the transfer AAAs as well, or would be.
Madam Chair,
Senator Yee.
So increase in workload means increase in caseload, more senior population needs help. Is this what you're talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, yes. That is what we're talking about here. The staffing ratio is when caseload increases, the staffing also increases, depending on what the caseload is and the overall changes for that caseload.
What is the predicted growth in senior population
in the next 8 months?
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, I don't know that. The answer off the top of my head about that. You mean in terms of the Medicaid caseload, the overall caseload?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, I don't recall.
Yeah, I mean, there must be an increase in senior population in the Medicaid caseload to justify for the demand for increase.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, yes, that is the case. And the Department of Administrative Services and also LFO have looked over the caseload projections and believe them to be reasonable at this point.
The increase is reasonable. The request for increase in hiring is reasonable and not reasonable.
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, the increase in caseload, the forecast of caseload, we believe is reasonable. We also believe that the staffing ratio is a reasonable one at this point in time. This reduction would simply delay hiring people to meet that growing caseload.
So the prediction is reasonable. So the reduction is unreasonable then.
Senator Shields.
Confusion on the reach.
And we appreciate it.
I feel like the guy has several dishes spinning in the air at once. I'm having trouble keeping them all balanced here. A while ago, Mr. Albeck said that like 50% of a certain staff group had worked less than a year. That tells me that there's a problem already with SDSD because you got a lot of turnover.
Now,
if you delay increasing the hiring of these folks by 8 months, is this going to exacerbate the morale and increase the workload on a staff that's already relatively new? John, I don't know whether I asked you that question, Roger, or the universe, but can you follow my question?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I do follow it. I don't have an answer, but I follow your question. And it could be referred to Mr. Auerbach.
Well, I mean, to me, it's a serious issue. I mean, half the staff new. We're asking that relatively new staff to increase their workload while the learning curve is pretty steep because we're going to delay these hires another 8 months. It seems like a difficult kind of balancing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Well, the answer is a lot of jobs are more or less entry-level jobs, and they're going to fluctuate. A year in a lot of jobs is a long-term employment. And you can't necessarily guarantee by any kind of salaries and perks somebody's going to stay in a job for 100 years or 5 years or 10 years or whatever the case might be. You try to make the job as practical as they can be to try to attract people to stay in a job as long as possible. But part of that's just something you learn to live with and you perform with regardless of whether or not you're able to keep them a year and 2 days or a year and 6 months or whatever the case might be. So, there's just no way in business or anything. I think probably if you would look back on your own experience, associate pastor of a church probably doesn't stay as long as has a full pastor once he's established and he's been going well. He moves on and changes his experience and goes on into something climbing the ladder. So there's a lot of that in government jobs. There's a lot of it in jobs in private business. So just having a long-term staff isn't necessarily indicative of something that you don't just have to work with from time to time and accept in a certain portion of it, because I think you'll find as you get up the ladder in those various departments, you'll find a longer-term staff, if you will, in the lower areas, because people learn and expand their knowledge and expand their opportunities and take further education and go up the ladder. So that doesn't bother me as particularly as much as anybody on a job for a couple of months, I'll be able to start pulling the weight, even if it's just on-the-job training, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Why don't we move on. Actually, I want you to explain this next one because it explains some of what we just did as well. And I want the committee to understand this before we close and all get beat up. So, John,
Madam Chair, number six is to remove one package that is in the governor's recommended budget, the employment initiative of it's about $2.1 million of general funds. And I'm further recommending that we place this on a potential add-back list where it can find its appropriate priority along with the other Department of Human Resources reductions that may be coming or have already occurred. I cannot criticize this package at all. We heard last Thursday when we were working on the Vocational Rehabilitation Division budget that a portion of this package, $670,000, will be used to match federal dollars on a 4-to-1 basis. That's an extremely good match. Another point that has been made when we were talking about this employment initiative was the notion that the Medicaid waiver that allows many persons with disabilities to retain their benefits, their health benefits, while they still work. That seems like this is kind of to augment that program or to meet the growing demand that is predicted to occur because of that waiver. So, again, this is not a criticism of the package. It is just simply to say that this is $2.1 million of general fund that needs to find a home perhaps somewhere, and I would recommend putting it on a potential ad list, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think you just talked yourself out of the deduction.
No, actually,
Madam Chair and Senator E., you know, it's hard to be an analyst in this particular case. It really is. It really is.
And I'd just like to say that this number six and number four actually have, I believe, some relationship from the point of view that maybe the committee could make some decisions based upon one or the other. Gary Weeks told us that this number six was really the number one enhancement that was being asked for, and I sympathize with that. I also sympathize with what we heard the other day and how it does help you know, with putting people to work and so forth. And so this is being recommended to put on an ad back list, but we're also trying to make accommodations so that there's something there that can be added back. So I hope I made that at least hazy about what we have here.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure let me confirm what you just said. I mean, if the employment initiative is one of the top priorities for this division, mm-hmm. you know, many of these are pretty painful to sit here and talk mm-hmm. to you about it. I know they're painful on your side to talk about. The employment initiative, it not only focuses on the employment of people who are ready to go to work, but it also focuses on, we've got 2,500 cases in DRD that $600,000 gets federal fund to match. And I'm grateful that you included on ad back list. We're going to do everything we can to continue to keep pressure on and hope that you find the money for the ad back list, because I'm real passionate about this. We've worked for a year to get federal waivers to let people with disabilities go to work. We have a partnership like we've never had before between two divisions, which is, I think, is something we ought to encourage within DHR to employ people with disabilities. We have jobs for these people. They're going to pay taxes. And I know you heard all these arguments mm-hmm. from me already. So my hope is that we won't lose an opportunity in this legislative session to do something pretty remarkable, and not only in the state, but in this country.
Which is why it's part of the recommendation to put it back on the ad back list. And what we're intending on doing is, after we go through each one of these divisions, is we are going to have a list. And if we would make that decision today, probably it would be there. But then every day we're dealing with a different division, and that day, that's the most important thing. And so what we want to do, and you will have an opportunity to continue to convince members of the committee that this is a very important area, and I see it as a very important area myself, which is why it will be on the ad back list. But it is, we're also trying to accommodate being able to have it actually be placed mm-hmm. back in.
And was there a question on this?
Well, I didn't want to take away from your comments there.
I was finished.
Well, in relation to number four, would that be one of your high priorities as well? If you're okay, we're looking at about 9 different items on this page.
I'm sure Representative Loken, that's got to be a high priority for us too. I mean, I believe the impairment costs will be funded, and they'll be funded out of the wages.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that's what's going to happen, which in turn means the wages will be lower in assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, and adult foster homes,
mm-hmm.
and they will have more trouble attracting a good workforce. But it's a high priority, and there are a number of hard choices to make. But as the chair has pointed out, you still have some other divisions come before you, and as a department, if given the opportunity, we will tell you which of these choices are the most critical. I will tell you which are the most critical across the department.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Madam Chair, just for the sake of comment, to me that does seem an important item to consider as far as a potential addition to the ad back list, or at least part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Number four.
Senator Yee, do you think we can have an estimate that if we keep this employment initiative, how many people can we help to get back to work, and what kind of tax revenue do we anticipate from their going back to work? So the return really could possibly justify for the $2.1 million general fund investment.
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, I'm sure that the Department of Human Resources can provide that information. Can you? I'm speaking for them. And
I'm sure there's some guesswork involved in how many people are going to get through and what kind of jobs they're going to have, and then therefore what amount of tax they pay. But I mean, we can work on it and see what we can provide.
Because you mentioned you can help 2,500 disabled.
I'm sure there are 2,500 current caseload in DRD. that are served by this money. Remember, I think you pointed this out last time, that the package includes SDS buying services from DRD and then getting the 4-to-1 match. And that's the other thing you walk away from here. You walk away from a 4-to-1 match, and I think maybe that's what persuaded Chiquita to want to put this back on the ad list, that and other reasons.
In addition to the good match, I think it would be useful to know how many tax returns can we get from helping people go back to work.
We'll do what we can, Senator Yee, to try to give you some idea on that.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next three items are not huge items, but the first is a recommendation to add general fund of $723,350 to fill a revenue hole. Senate Bill 307 would have increased nursing facility and other facility, long-term care facility fees. We did not expect it to pass at all, and this is a recommendation to fill the revenue hole that those dollars would have filled. So this is $723,350 general fund addition.
This is the $20 a bed.
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, I believe so. Number eight, if I may go ahead, is an Attorney General hourly rate reduction. I've tagged a note on here to modify slightly if DHRs, and it should be 4% reductions are accepted, because I believe in the first bullet there was some reduction of Attorney General costs. I would like to get the right amount, but intent here is to reduce the hourly, or the intent is to reflect the reduction in hourly rates for the Attorney General from $92 down to $90.
Minister.
Representative Strobeck.
It looks to me like that's added, or that's counted on here twice, John, because under the DHR reductions, one of the things that they've suggested is reduced funds for AG, and then you're doing the same thing down there. Are you doubling that?
Madam Chair and Representative Strobeck, I don't think I am. I think that the Attorney General's reduction in the DHR 4% are hours. And as I said, I would want to change this amount, the 8837, to reflect that reduction in hours, if in fact that was what was done. Now, assuming that that's not part, whatever part is not part of the DHR 4% reduction, I would recommend taking, whatever that is. But it will be something I predict less than $8,837 general fund. The final point on this sheet is really a technical adjustment. As you'll recall from a long time ago, the Board of Nursing's budget includes some federal funds. The way that occurs is that there are some other funds within the Board of Nursing budgets that are sent or transferred to SDSC, and they are in turn matched with federal funds. This calls for an increase of $232,920 of other funds and a like amount of federal funds, which the total amount then is sent back to the Board of Nursing, and that's a budget that has already been signed by the governor. Likewise, it is likely that the long-term care ombudsman budget will require some technical adjustments within SDSC's budget. We would do that after we have concluded the work on the long-term care ombudsman budget. We haven't worked that budget yet.
I thought we already did it.
No.
Madam Chair and Senator Yee, we had a hearing on the long-term care ombudsman budget. We haven't had a work session on it yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator, Representative Strobeck.
Madam Chair, I'd like to go back to number five, if I could just a second, and ask maybe the division, how you came up with this list of recommended changes, because like Senator Fisher said a few minutes ago, we're talking about tens and
hundreds of millions, and it seems, I don't know, kind of extremely getting down to minutiae to say delay hiring or reduce facilities maintenance by 75%. What does that mean? And which facilities are you talking about?
Madam Chair, Roger can probably give you details, but let me make sure that one thing, if we didn't recommend these changes, we responded to a request for a 4% reduction.
Oh, I understand.
You asked us how we would take those, and we said, in our judgment, this is the best way to take a 4% reduction, and it does get down to some level of detail. If we're trying to figure out how we manage this budget, if we had to take a 4%.
Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, I think, I mean, the clearest answer I can give you is that we looked at all, as you asked us to do, all administrative cuts, and we spent a lot of time and effort going over the minutiae and going over areas that we felt that would stay away from direct delivery of services to clients. And that's why you see things like, you know, that look like a relatively small piece here, a small piece there, because we were again trying to stay away from those cuts that would in fact increase our service to clients. So that's why you see the facilities are facilities where it's facilities where we rent and lease, and facilities maintenance basically, you know, I hate to say that we're going to have dirty buildings, and I mean obviously we're going to take care of the health and safety, but we're going to delay maintenance where we can.
Well, tell you this, Carl, you're not talking about reducing the maintenance of all your facilities by 75%. What is that?
We basically take, Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, we're taking the amount that we have budgeted for facilities maintenance, and we're reducing it by 75% in the next plan. That's our proposal.
So doesn't that result in dirty offices then?
Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, we hope it won't. These are not easy reductions to propose, but again, we would rather try to defer maintenance than to make reductions that have direct impact on our clients.
I understand that, but I mean, you must have something in mind. What is not going to get done?
The exact.
Madam Chair, I think a lot of that is what she's talking about is Representative Strobeck's housekeeping. What we're talking about is maintenance. That they're not going to replace floor casings or floor moldings or something like that. It's not going to sweep the floors.
Well, in leased buildings, I wouldn't expect to be replacing door frames.
Right.
Of all buildings aren't leased.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, for the record, I'm Dan Kaplan, Deputy Administrator of Senior and Disabled Services. The kinds of work that we won't do are the kinds of work, for example, that we would need to make a space accessible for people who are disabled. So, for example, in a building, in a new office building, if we were going in, we would not pay extra money to have electric doors put in. That might be an example of the sort of work we would do. They're the kinds of things that are necessary to us to do given our business, but in theory, I guess we can get away with putting off a little bit, and that would be a good example. Things to, in essence, make a place more usable for our clients, and that costs us a little money over and above the rental cost.
Well, I hate to beat a dead horse on this, but it sounds like just about everything here, delay replacing computers, delay rehiring, and make it less convenient, does not sound like it's meeting client needs. You know, I don't know. It just sounds like this is kind of the kind of thing that government is known for making accessing services more difficult, more delays, more all those kinds of things. And I recognize, Director Weeks, you didn't volunteer these, and they were asked of you, but I just wonder if this is really the best way to find a reduction is to essentially make it less convenient, less customer friendly for the services that are being provided.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Strobeck, as Elijah said, we spent a lot of time going through all the lines of administrative costs that we had to try to find things that we could do that wouldn't have an impact on my service. We're a human services organization. Everything we do has some impact. I mean, we could have, you know, delayed filling accounting positions and those kinds of things. We've had delays getting checks off from providers who are providing services, and in which case you would hear from them almost immediately if our checks from them were 2 or 3 days later than they are now, you know. So there were a lot of hard choices to make, and we gave you the best, best that we could get.
And we'll probably say again. Okay. Well, staff has gone over the recommendations. Representative Ross?
I just wanted to call attention that there are two other items in this budget that were not on staff's recommended list, and I'm not surprised because they are additions rather than subtractions, but I do want to just say those out loud for the record. One is Oregon Project Independence. It is always a problem because it is general fund dollars. But it is one of the components of it helping Oregon's continuum of services healthy. It's a small number of hours for people who are just above the poverty level to help them stay in their own homes who are not eligible for Medicaid. So and one of the things that I think is important about this program is it is a service to people who have worked all their lives. This is not people who've been on welfare. This is people who have worked, who've earned money, who are now retired, and are just above that eligibility level for Medicaid services. And the few hours that we give them, 4 to 6 to 8 hours a week, is really important to them. So I just want to say that we do not have the increase in this budget that would match the projected caseload that goes with that. The other issue is an equity issue that is between the different the AAAs that are run by local government as opposed to the units that are run by state government, the equity issue that was brought forward earlier. And again, it's a $3.9 million item to make them equal to the others and have the same amount of money for services go out to those folks. I think that local government is subsidizing these programs, and a partial payment would make it possible for them to continue. But I think that we have to face the fact that if we don't do anything about this problem, that some of these programs will be returned to the state, and so then we'll have to deal with them. Clackamas and Lynn Benton Lincoln, where Senator Yee and I are, and then I think there's one other, the Mid-Valley.
Madam Chair and Representative Ross, one of the transfer AAAs is Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service.
Okay, and I just wanted to state that on the record that these were things that we had been requested that are not in the recommendations, and again, I understand that because there are additions instead of subtractions, and we are performing subtraction today in our arithmetic game.
Madam Chair, I'd move the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendations.
Senator Timms has moved the legislative. He's here. LFO's recommendations for the FCSC budget, and we have spent the last 2 hours going through those. We'll have discussion in a second.
Okay.
That is the DHR reshoot of the governor's recommended budget. LFO recommends not funding the AAA non-Medicaid reimbursable activities at $700,000, food stamp error rate remediation $1.2 million, or 12 FTE, spousal pay increase over the governor's recommended budget of $800,000.
Madam Chair, may I interrupt you, please?
Sure.
On the AAA non-Medicaid reimbursable, it's about $782,000,
okay.
So it should be $0.8
million. Okay, $0.8 million. Number two, the spousal pay reduced by $2.6 million general fund, and then accept a Medicaid upper limit payment mechanism with an initial payment of $39.9 million general fund, or other funds, we're not sure, and $59.5 million federal funds. That will accommodate nursing home facility rebasing at $6.6 million. State funds, community-based rates increased $3.2 million. State funds, reduce impairment reduction impairments by $2.7 million. Accept the 4% reductions in $2.1 million general fund, $2.1 million federal fund. DHR's recommendation, or their, well, I guess we'll call them recommendations. The five components of those, $0.8 million general fund for reducing services and supplies, including delay in replacing computers, reduced travel, reduced funds for AG. Reduce the temporary staff by 20% for $97,000 and $34 general fund. Hold central office positions vacant 4 months instead of two for $65,560 general fund. Reduce facilities maintenance by 75% or $164,480 general fund dollars. Delay hiring additional workload increase by eight months for $1 million. Remove the employment initiative for $2.1 million general fund, but place it on the add-back list. Recommend adding $723,350 general fund to fill revenue holes caused by the non-passage of Senate Bill 307. Reduce the Attorney General hourly rate overall of $8,837. There may be a technical change to that once we look at the 4% reductions. And deal with the Board of Nursing, the technical changes of $232,920 other funds, and for the long-term care ombudsman for $230,920 federal funds.
These are the two combined?
No. The Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Board of Nursing alone is $232,920 other funds and the $239,920 federal funds. We don't yet know long-term care on
Thank you for clarifying that. I was wondering about that when I was looking at that. Is there a discussion? Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I just, for my own knowledge here, being new on the Ways and Means, if something's not listed as an add-back on any of these things, does that mean it's totally off the table? If circumstances came about later on, will there be opportunities to discuss other things that might be added?
Actually, right now might be an appropriate time for you as a member of the subcommittee to mention something that you would like to have on the agenda.
Well, I guess potentially I'm not proud, and I'm not trying to be, how should I put it, especially on my treatment, I would just say all the things have been cut. I would not be unhappy to see his ad back.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you, Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Logan.
Madam Chair, I want to express my concern, too, about the equity issue and taking another look at that, if we could.
Okay.
OPI has also always been something that I see quite a bit of value in. So.
Okay. Thank you. And Senator Shields.
Yes, Madam Chair. Of course, I've been raising the equity issue all along, so I'm going to say ditto to that. But I just have to say that I cannot support, maybe I should start by saying I can support about five of these bullets, but I cannot support the spousal pay reduction. We've talked about that, nor the impairment reduction and the employment initiative, among others.
Okay.
I have to be on record that I cannot support that.
Okay. Representative Ross.
I want to say how much I appreciate the staff work on this, both in the department and John's work on this, because it is a tremendous amount of work to go through the detail to kind of make this thing fit together. And this is a very difficult area because you have increases in population, you have increases in frailty, you have increases in age, and so it's a multiplier effect. It's an explosion that is different than some other parts of the government where you're just looking at one kind of inflation or population growth. So I want to say that, recognize the effort to contain this budget is harder than many other areas. I am very concerned about the equity issue because I think that in the long run, we will lose money by not addressing that. And I would really ask that staff go back, relook at the equity issue, because it concerns me that we will, in fact, lose money by not doing some kind of partial adjustment. And then just on a personal note, I want to talk to staff again about the spousal pay, both at the LFO and the department, because I think we need to work out some way that we're all clear on how exceptions are made and how much of this money we really expect to be just general fund. If that's a high priority for us, then we cut it loose to the federal funds. And so I'd like to really work on that. I'm not suggesting adding to that. I'm just saying that I'd like to work on that a little bit so we have clarity and they don't go off and do something. We say, well, that wasn't what you agreed to do, and we understand what we're expecting of them. So I think this is a lot of work. I'm going to vote no because I love these people and I can't stand not to give them everything they want.
Well, Representative Brock, if I vote yes, it doesn't mean I don't love them.
I always do that,
Senator Yee. I just want to say I can't support these recommendations at this point because I think it should be a very high priority to help the disabled citizens find work, especially when federal government allows a waiver so they continue to qualify for their Medicaid benefit and work. And I think working helps their dignity and their quality of life. And I think the return in investment justifies for this $2.1 million general fund, and especially when it gets 1-to-4 ratio of federal matching funds. I feel this is a very high priority that we should not remove from the budget. And I'm also concerned with the impairment reduction. I think that whenever there's increase in labor and help, the provider justify in getting their reimbursement. Otherwise, we may have a hard time getting our Medicaid patients nursing home services. And I'm also concerned with the OPI not getting increased. This is a good program to help senior citizens stay at home. They work hard all their lives, like Representative Roth said, and I think we need to at least keep up with inflation to help these folks. So I'm very concerned, and I'm afraid I can't support it at this point.
Okay. Senator Shields?
Yes, Madam Chair. I guess I started this discussion with a very simplistic saying that can't support 2, 4, and 8 to make it as quick as possible. And I won't expand on that, but I do have a question. Is there any chance that we can indicate support for the items of the support, or do we have to just vote yes or no on this entire I realize that was the motion of our co-chair made.
That is the motion, and that's how we have to vote today. And that's why I wanted to entertain the suggestions of committee members about what they would like to see as things on the add back, so that we really can look at all of the things once we get through the divisions of the DHR budget and prioritize what this committee, where we would like those monies to go, because I think we have to see the big picture rather than divisional pictures as we go along. We are seeing these separately, but I really believe we have to have a big picture at the very end and make our determination based upon that. We've all been here, and so we will come then with better knowledge to be able to make those decisions. So,
having heard you say that, then I would, and knowing how to count as I do, I would suggest that we need to consider putting the, and I just say this for the record, the food stamp error rate remediation of 1.2 on an add back list, along with the spousal pay, the impairment reduction, and the employee initiative. I think those all should be on add back list if, in fact, there's an affirmative vote for this budget today.
Okay.
And of course, that includes the equity issue.
I'm sure I feel I have to say something. First day I've
been. Senator Kim.
So last session, I sit in this budget committee through the whole work session. And I know it's not easy, so I commend every one of you for what you do. I commend the chair of the committee for what she's doing, because this is not easy. And you have to take this it's easy to pot shot this budget. It's 22% of our budget is state government. Next, education, this is our biggest budget. So it's easy to take shots in all departments and create problems. And that's why we have to pass it in total. Mm-hmm. But we'd never get through this. We'd be here in September fighting this issue. And I certainly hope that there will be some add-backs in the all of you that have voiced your opinions on different areas will certainly be taken into consideration, mainly by the chair of this committee, because she's the one that runs it. She's the one that controls the committee. But I want you to know I appreciate the work you do and what you go through on this committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Strobeck.
I just want to say that I totally support the work of the Senior Disabled Services and that. And a number of other bills that I've sponsored, especially one for medically fragile children. That's one that I'm still working on. These are the folks who are the most vulnerable in our society, and if as a state we have any role to play, it ought to be to support and provide services to these folks. And I would also like to comment about the spousal pay and the impairment reduction. I think there's both issues circulating around those, while I think they're probably helpful, I'm not sure that we've heard real factual documentation on each one of those programs, and I think that would be helpful to be able to make a decision, especially the impairment reduction. I think that there's no doubt that there are increased services required, but I doubt if every one of those things is accounted for. I'm sure there's some sort of shifting, as every business does. When you look for a greater pot of money to help make things balance, and I understand that. I would put the employment initiative at the top of my list for potential add-backs, as is noted here. I'd also like to ask staff a question, if you have this detail at your fingertips. The total budget for the Senior Disabled Services Division and the amount of reduction that is being the total amount of reduction that's being recommended with these lists of recommendations?
Madam Chair and Representative Strobeck, I have some of that. We're looking at about $414.6 million in general fund. That was in the printed governor's recommended budget. In the reshoot, we have, it appears, after the reshoot, and we, again, in this recommendation, we haven't funded everything, but we have 417.1. So it would be 417.1 less about 2.8 not funded. You know, our recommendation would be not funding those in the reshoot, and that doesn't get to the then more reductions or enhancements, in these recommendations. So after the first item, I have $414.3 million. I'm going to leave out the initial Medicaid or Medicare upper limit payment, but I will add in the nursing facility rebates and the community-based rates increase of 9.8. Got an impairment reduction of 2.7. 4% is 2.1.
Employment Initiative is another 2.1. Add of about 0.7.
I don't have a chance.
That's my problem here.
Oh, I thought you were pushing all those numbers.
Nine.
Okay.
About three net. It's about 415, 416, roughly.
Could you say that again, please?
Well, I hesitate to even say it because I want to get my addition all in line. Okay. But I can provide that information tomorrow if you'd like.
No, what I was looking for was some sort of a ratio between the total budget and the amount of the reductions.
Right.
Okay.
I think the bottom line is it's very small in terms of the total.
I think we got what we were trying to point out, which is it's a $417 million budget, and we're making some fairly, with the big picture of this budget.
It's almost a wash. It's almost a wash.
Okay, we're adding some puts and takes.
Yeah.
Puts and takes, almost a wash. So, therefore, if there's no further discussion, Cheryl, why don't you call the roll?
No.
Senator Kim?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
No.
Representative
Fox?
No.
Representative
Wilkins?
Aye, with comments that I've already made regarding Ted Best, if possible.
Representative
Krobeck. Yes. Do I need to declare a conflict of interest?
Why would you need to do that?
Because I'm a senior.
No.
You voted
no. You voted no, so.
Yeah, come on. You're serious, though.
Right. Yeah. That passes this particular budget. And I do want to say that I would add practically everything that's in this budget back in as well, just as Senator Fisher would. And I am very serious when I ask you to please advocate for this budget, the DHR budget as a whole, as we move on. And I want to see you guys with those things on your chest in education budget hearing, please, because we read them here, but they need to read them there. And go and see the governor with those on your chest as well. And just one second, I want to make another announcement before we adjourn. I understand tomorrow between 1:30 and 3:30, the House will be in session. So if we could have all of the subcommittee members here at 1 o'clock, between 1 and 1:30, we'd like to finish, hopefully, the bill, Senate Bill 405. So we would do that one on our agenda from 1 to 1:30. I don't know what it is.
We don't
know
what
it
is.
No.
Oh, it has to do with housing.
Madam Chair, could I ask one question while we have the...
Housing for persons with developmental disabilities. So, Senator Fisher.
Yes, Madam Chair. Gary, if you were to replace some of the buildings over here, say in the state hospital, with a more ideal facility or something like that, is there any federal funds that would come to bear in the actual construction, or do those have to all come out of the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Fisher, I haven't thought about this, but I'm sure there'd be some amount of federal funding if we were to build new construction facilities. I'm sure there'd be some amount of federal funding that would be available. Probably not much, because it's about 10% of
years.
There'd be some small amount.
Okay. Thank you. With that, we will adjourn.